Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny.
On today's show, Oliver Millman on his book, The Insect Crisis, The Fall of the Tiny Empires That Run the World.
Oliver Millman is a British journalist and the environment correspondent at The Guardian. He currently lives in New York City, and today we're going to talk about Oliver's book, which is The Insect Crisis, The Fall of the Tiny Empires That Run the World. Oliver, welcome to Little Atoms.
Hi, good to be with you, Neil.
So the book starts off with a sort of speculative fiction idea of what could possibly happen if there was a mass extinction of insects, some of the sort of cascading issues that would happen to us human beings in particular. So tell us something about that, first of all.
Yeah, so when I thought about writing a book about insects, which I never really thought I would do, but when I realised they were in such kind of deep trouble, I thought about how best to convey that. And I think the first kind of hurdle you need to get over for the kind of casual reader is, why would I care? Why would I care that insects are declining so rapidly in many parts of the world? And I kind of wanted to kind of illustrate, I suppose, off the bat, why it's important, why the insect crisis is consequential for us as humans, why it's potentially devastating for the world. And so I kind of wanted to kind of illustrate this kind of worst case scenario of what a world without insects would look like. And it's quite a grim place. It's certainly not a place we'd want to be in, and it's not a place we'd survive in really for longer than a few months. The kind of great biologist Theo Wilson took a stab at that a few years ago, and he thought we'd maybe last kind of 3 or 4 months, I think, before kind of mass starvation and other things finished us off. So it's not a very kind of, is kind of quite a bleak kind of scenario. One I don't think we'll kind of get to quite, but I wanted to kind of highlight the importance of insects, and hopefully that opening did the trick.
And what sort of thing? What are the sort of the worst case scenario things that could happen?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people will be kind of aware of how important insects are for pollination. You know, 1 in every 3 bites of food is the kind of famous ratio, and it depends on how you quantify it. But certainly, a huge amount of our nutritionally valuable foods come from insect pollination, fruits, vegetables, kind of the colourful things on your plate. So without that, you would get severe malnutrition and starvation in many parts of the world. You're already starting to see that in some places. There was a study that came out in January finding that there's about 500,000 early deaths a year happening around the world due to loss of pollinators, because we're losing bees and beetles, butterflies, flies, the kind of things that pollinate our foods. It's 500,000 deaths a year already happening because of heart disease, stroke, diabetes, cancers, that sort of thing, because of that lack of nutrition. So obviously a complete loss of insects would compound that massively, and we'd see, huge global food insecurity. We'd also just see a general deterioration in our, and a collapse really in our ecosystems, waste disposal, the kind of cycling of nutrients through plants to propagate them. We would essentially have the kind of life support systems of our environment around us kind of crash down around our ears. It would be a particularly grim place, and one we really wouldn't want to visit.
And it's amazing how some of the things that we think of as like incredibly commonplace have such very specific pollinators, and I'm thinking particularly here about chocolate. Tell us something about how we get chocolate.
Yeah, we don't really think about it, do we? But I mean, the world's entire supply of chocolate is dependent on this tiny little midge that is small enough to crawl into the opening of the cacao plant to pollinate it. And so, you know, you have this kind of multi-billion pound industry that's dependent on this tiny midge, and nobody thinks about that when you're eating your chocolate bar. But that, I suppose, sums up, I think, what place insects have in our lives. They're kind of seemingly everywhere, but at the same time nowhere. They're kind of annoyingly around us at all times, but at the same time we don't really think about them. We don't think about their importance. We don't think about what they do for us. We don't think about what they do for the world. And so, yeah, I think chocolate is a really good example of that. Without flies, these tiny little flies, these midges, we'd have no chocolate. We'd have no kind of ice cream either, or coffee, or a lot of the other things that we really kind of cherish and make life kind of worthwhile. So, yeah, I think it's really kind of sobering to think about it in that way.
I think if people have heard anything about an insect crisis, they will probably have heard something about issues with bees. And we will come back to bees specifically a bit later on in the interview and look at them in some detail. But more in general, for a while, when did entomologists first begin to notice that there was a crisis?
Yeah, I mean, it's been talked about in entomological circles for a little while. But I think the kind of big kind of breakthrough in terms of kind of broader kind of public awareness of the problem probably came through around 2017. You had this kind of big study coming out of Germany, and that was kind of widely publicized, that found that the annual average weight of flying insects caught in traps in nature reserves in Germany, across Germany, had fallen by 76% since 1989. So Germany had lost kind of three quarters of its flying insects since the Berlin Wall came down, which is kind of incredible to think about. And these are in protected areas as well, not kind of in cities or, you know, agricultural areas. In summer, it was even worse. I think it was about 82% decline. So quite astonishing level of loss. And we started then to be introduced to terms like, you know, insectageddon, insect apocalypse, that kind of thing from the media, because then there were kind of subsequent studies coming out from kind of rainforests of Puerto Rico. There's been reports on declines of British butterflies. I spoke to one guy who's been charting the loss of insects in Denmark. He found there's been a 97% decrease since the 90s of insects in rural Denmark. I mean, we've started getting these kind of glimpses in just a few years of these declines. And scientists have been trying to kind of get their heads around that since, about, you know, how widespread is that? How uniform is it? What are the kind of causes? But certainly pretty much every entomologist you speak to now, very, very clear that, you know, this is a quite real and quite serious decline of insects that poses, you know, big problems for us.
There's some real great characters that are quoted in the book. Just a quick shout out in particular for Erica McAllister of the Natural History Museum, who I've spoken to in the past. But the guy that you just mentioned in Denmark, you didn't mention how he went about studying the decline of insects in particular. Tell us about his experiment. It's great.
Yeah, well, he kind of hit upon, so this guy's called Anders Pepe Moller, and he's a Danish scientist, and his big thing is birds. He's really into his birds, and he noticed that there were just fewer and fewer birds around in the countryside in Denmark, and he just thought maybe that's because the insects aren't there anymore. Birds have nothing to eat. And so he decided to test this in quite an unusual way by basically getting his old 1960s beat up Ford Anglia car and driving up and down the same stretch of road in Denmark about nine times a day and counting the number of bugs that hit his windscreen. And he's been doing that every summer since 1997, which is quite kind of dedication to quite an unusual experiment. So he was kind of putting kind of numbers, he was putting data onto this phenomenon called the windscreen effect, or the windshield effect if you're here in America, which is basically this kind of understanding that some people might have of a certain age, that when you were a kid, when you were being driven across the countryside, you'd kind of end up with loads of bugs smeared on the windscreen because they'd all been flying into them. And now that seems to happen less and less. It's just, you know, it's a less common occurrence. And Anders, yeah, he turned this into a, you know, a scientific paper, and he found that he found there was, 97% decline in insects in his windscreen since the 90s, which is kind of incredible. He said a lot of days he'd just be driving around and there'd be nothing hitting the windscreen at all. So, that was kind of one of the more unusual ways to document this kind of decline.
The other side to the insect crisis is not just an idea that insects could have some sort of mass extinction, which will cause us problems, but also that the balance of different types of insects could change. So some good insects, and I'm using inverted commas here as well, but just for brevity, some insects that we consider good could decline rapidly, while other types of insects that we don't necessarily like could vastly increase in numbers.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, insects really are, they're the great survivors. They survived five mass extinctions. They were here before the dinosaurs. They were here after the dinosaurs. And there's a million named species. There's, maybe 5 million really that we don't know about, maybe 10 million, we're not sure. I mean, there's such a variety of insects that they're not all going to die out, certainly not before humans. So we're not going to lose all insects. And I tried to make that clear in the book that they're not on this like steep slope to zero where we have no insects around at all. But what we're doing is creating a world of kind of winners and losers. And the winners are those kinds of insects, generally speaking, that we don't want around so much. And the losers are the things we really cherish, the bumblebees, the butterflies, the beetles, the things that we kind of value kind of economically in terms of our food production, but also aesthetically as well. If you think about some of the most beautiful butterfly species, for example, in the world, they're being kind of wiped out at the moment. Things that kind of bring real joy when you go for a walk. So yeah, we're kind of replacing those things that we really value with things that we value far less. I mean, if you take mosquitoes, for example, what do they like? They like kind of, generally speaking, they like warm, damp conditions. And that's entirely what we're doing through climate change. The area of the world that can support disease-carrying mosquitoes is growing towards the poles. So it's expected that a billion extra people around the world are going to be exposed to, mosquito-borne viruses spread by mosquitoes. The same with other creatures we don't want around, like kind of bed bugs, cockroaches, things like that. Things that do well in kind of human-dominated systems with kind of waste around for them to eat, who are adapting well to human life. I mean, those are the kind of creatures that will do well, and those that can't won't do well. So it's a pretty bad trade-off that we're making at the moment.
And I'm glad you brought up mosquitoes, because this is a great example of something that it seems like an absolute no-brainer, that it would be a good thing if there was less mosquitoes. And indeed, as you said, because of climate change, one of the things that is driving this insect crisis, of course, mosquitoes are going to affect even more people. They already kill more people than any other animal. So what are some of the reasons why it would not be? Because there has obviously been already, without thinking about the concept of an insect crisis or climate change, plans to try to eradicate mosquitoes by humans from various places. What are some reasons then why that would not be a good idea?
Yeah, there are lots of studies and kind of research efforts going on underway to try and get rid of them. I think through the process of writing this book, I spoke to the kind of two or three people in the whole world who would be really devastated if mosquitoes were to be wiped out. I spoke to one research scientist who's been working on genetically modifying them so they die off for 20 odd years. And she said she just had this epiphany once looking under a microscope at how kind of beautiful they are. They're big kind of compound eyes and they're colorful wings. And she thought there may be a better way of doing this than just simply killing them all off. I mean, the arguments, like you said, there are strong arguments why you want to get rid of mosquitoes. I mean, not all of them carry disease, only a few of them do. So it's not like they're all kind of equally bad in that respect. But, lots of people do die from malaria and dengue and yellow fever and all these other things. So, there is a kind of compelling reason beyond them just being irritating. But the downside is you'd be removing a kind of foundational plank from the food chain for many creatures, kind of amphibians, birds, that kind of thing. They wouldn't have mosquitoes or the larva to eat anymore. And once you do that, you start getting into kind of unknown or unintended consequences, where you start seeing certain species decline because their food source has been taken away. we don't know. It's kind of an experiment you could only really run once it was done, unfortunately. So yeah, mosquitoes are obviously hated, but it's not as simple as saying we should just flick a switch and get rid of them. It's a little bit more complex than that. They, like everything else in the world, play a role in the food chain, in the world around us. They aren't just here pointlessly to annoy us and kill us off. They actually do things.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Oliver Millman, and we're talking about his book, The Insect Crisis, The Fall of the Tiny Empires That Run the World. And Oliver, we started talking a little bit before we broke about climate change. Let's talk about some other ways in which climate change in particular is driving the crisis in insects.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, climate change, I think, has only recently been thought by kind of scientists to be an issue for insects. I mean, we've been so focused on all the other impacts from the climate crisis, particularly on other kind of larger animals. You think about kind of polar bears drifting on bits of floating ice, for example. We don't really think about insects because they kind of seem to be, you know, small and quite portable, and, you know, they should be able to adapt. But, you know, there's been some kind of recent research showing that insects do really badly and are doing really badly in this kind of warming world. And apparently, if we get to kind of 3 degrees Celsius of warming, you know, half of all insect species will lose more than half of their current habitable range. So you're seeing shrinking of the area in which insects are able to thrive. Bumblebees, for example, are particularly badly suited for a kind of warming world. They're kind of sewn into their winter jackets at all times, aren't they? So if you think about bumblebees, but also butterflies, you're having these kind of big butterfly migrations in the US and Mexico here that are under threat because of climate change. And we're scrambling the seasons. I think that's really another important thing that is affecting insects too. Spring is arriving earlier and earlier. You're seeing that kind of documented in many places around the world now. You know, flowers are budding earlier in the year, and that kind of throws off the whole kind of chain of interactions you have between kind of flowers and insects and birds, and is kind of to the detriment of insects, really, that we've kind of messed up the seasons. So yeah, climate change is a big one, and it's one of the harder ones to contend with, of course, because you can do some kind of localized conservation work or ban certain pesticides or whatever it is to help insects, but climate change is going to keep rolling on for many years to come, even if we get our act together on cutting emissions. So it's going to prove to be a pretty serious issue for insects going forward.
Well, pesticides is going to come up next as well, because let's talk about how changes to the sort of industrialization of farming, I guess, across the world, and the introduction of, you know, chemical pesticides and herbicides and things has made a difference as well.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think a lot of people, when they think of farming, still thinks of, you know, this kind of family farm with, you know, an apple orchard and maybe like a field of crops and some pigs scattered around. But more and more, the world is moving towards this industrialized form of farming where you have just huge, enormous fields with kind of single monocultural crops in there, no variety there, no weeds at the edges that insects like to live on and can survive on. So you're kind of clearing out whole areas of the countryside, anything that insects can feed on and live on, getting rid of hedgerows, getting rid of all this kind of stuff that insects need to survive. So it's creating this kind of, yeah, this kind of poisonous kind of moonscape, really. If you're an insect, you just continually spraying these chemicals to get rid of pests, but they unfortunately also get rid of the things we see as beneficial, the butterflies and the beetles and the bees and all these other insects. So yeah, pesticides is a real problem, and the European Union has kind of acted on that, on some of the worst ones, but still in many countries, including UK, US and others, you've got these quite harmful pesticides. They're being applied supposedly to help yields, although that is questionable whether they actually help improve the crop. What we know for certain is that they are pretty devastating for insects.
So nicotinoids, which is one of the modern pesticides, which plays a quite a significant part, we think, in the decline of bees, which is where we're going next, is one of the things that the European Union have just come down quite hard on. It remains to see whether or not we will stay in that direction as well here. Well, I say you're in the US, but myself still in the UK. To get us into talking about bees, there's an amazing passage in this book where you talk about something that I was not aware that happened at all, which is the trade in pollination in the US in particular. So tell us something about, if you're a farmer in the Central Valley of California who owns an almond farm, how do you go about pollinating your almonds?
Yeah, I mean, this is the kind of industrialization of farming at its kind of zenith, really. If you go to this area of California, it's it's almost like a factory floor of farming. So anything that is not productive for producing crop has been cleared out of the way and replaced by rows and rows of crops. And almonds is one of the biggest. They produce kind of 80-90% of the world's almonds, I think, just from Central Valley of California. And because you've got rid of everything around the farm other than the crop, there is no habitat for bees or other pollinators, really, to pollinate your crop. So you've got a huge crop that needs to be pollinated, but no pollinators to do that. So what you have is each year this kind of enormous kind of pollination jamboree, where kind of every managed honeybee hive in America is strapped onto a lorry and driven to the Central Valley of California, and these bees are kind of set down next to the fields and released in order to pollinate the almonds. And then they then go on like a kind of tour, like a kind of band or something, or some kind of contracted worker. You know, you might go and pollinate some blueberries or some citrus or something else in another part of the country, because essentially all the wild bees are in decline or have been wiped out or just simply not large enough in number anymore to do that pollination service. So, yeah, you essentially turn beekeeping from this kind of hobby into this kind of quite grueling year-round agricultural contracting service. And the bees get kind of taken around on lorries to do that, which stresses them out. It kills a lot of them. A lot of them have to kind of cope with kind of disease and kind of outbreaks within the hives that need to be treated. It's a fairly kind of miserable life for bees. And what's worse, I kind of found out that there's a kind of growing bee rustling trade going on in California too, because the value of the pollination has become so high as the bees have become rarer. There are thieves now who will go out and steal the hives off the back of lorries and sell them on, because the bees become so valuable. So you have bee detectives now in California trying to hunt down these people.
So this trade in pollination became necessary because One of the reasons was because, as you said, the fields had been cleared. The wild population of bees and pollinators had gone, so it became necessary to industrialize it. But then suddenly, recently, that industry itself has been hit by a sudden collapse in bee numbers. So sum up for us, what has gone wrong with bees?
Yeah, well, I mean, it depends what you're talking about, because I think a lot of people think about, when they think about bees, they think about honeybees, right? You think about a kind of orange and black striped creature that buzzes around in a hive with lots of other bees and makes honey. And that is a honeybee. And honeybees are not native to all parts of the world, but they've been transported around the world because they're useful for agricultural production. So a lot of the time they outcompete the kind of native wild bees. If you think about bumblebees, solitary bees, like mason bees, for example, that kind of dig their holes in nests in the ground or in wood or something like that. And so honeybees have become like the kind of avatar, really, for bee conservation. And, you know, they do face issues. They, like I'm saying, they face kind of disease that's spread around the world between in this kind of trade of, you know, pollination and hives moving them around, spreads disease. They're suffering from, you know, climate change and loss of habitat like every other kind of insect. But they have humans to look after them. So they, you know, they, we can kind of keep their numbers up in some degree. Kind of wild bees, your bumblebees, for example, they don't have that luxury. They don't have humans really looking after them to the same degree. So they're suffering from all these effects. They're suffering from loss of habitat. They're suffering from climate change. They're suffering from pesticides. They're suffering from disease that is spread around. They're suffering from being outcompeted by the honeybees. They really are suffering a really tough time. We've made the world really hard for bees in many respects. And as much as we like to think we like bees, there's lots of people who join Save the Bees kind of groups. We need to be doing far more to protect their numbers, because from a selfish point of view, they're probably one of the most important creatures in the world in terms of human perspective.
There was a thing called colony collapse that happened relatively recently, as I said, where a lot of sort of industrial bees, farmed bees, started, mass numbers of them started dying off. What do we know about that?
Yeah, this is where you would just go to your hive and then it will just be empty. It's just empty to bees. And, you know, for a few years, beekeepers were absolutely bewildered why this was happening. And there was this kind of fear that went around the world, you know, 10, 15 years ago, that, you know, we'd just see the end of bees because of colony collapse disorder, where the, you know, the queen would leave or die off, or the bees would all leave or die. And this has been a problem, continues to be a problem. Still not entirely clear why this has been happening, but it's most likely linked to some of those things I've been mentioning before: pesticide use, habitat loss. That sort of thing has caused it. There's less fear around at the moment that colony collapse disorder itself will cause a huge extinction of bees at a kind of a widespread scale. But certainly it's one of the factors that has caused people to be very worried about the future of bees.
Obviously, when we think about what's being done about mitigating climate change, it's this huge problem that it's going to take an entire world to get together and solve together. But it seems like there are things that, again, beyond solving climate change, beyond, you know, taking on the agribusiness, chemical multinationals and what have you, there are things that everybody can do to try to help insects on a relatively small level. So what are some of the things that would help?
As kind of farmland has become so uniform now, so kind of monocultural, people's gardens are actually one of the most diverse areas left, really, of habitat for bees. And you're seeing that now. Like when I was in London last time, I could notice how people's gardens are changing a bit, in that, you know, people are becoming less fussy, I suppose, about, you know, having a very closely cut lawn and very nicely ordered flowers from around the world that look pretty and that kind of thing. And just letting things grow a bit, because that's what insects really love. They love, you know, a bit of vegetation, native plants. They like leaves to be kind of left as they fall rather than being raked up. They obviously don't like the lawn being cut close and, you know, chemicals thrown all over it. So if you can avoid doing that, if you do have a garden, then that's really useful. And it's nice to see that there's been a bit of a rethink from some people on that. So that's one thing you can do. You know, buying organic food has some merit to it, although obviously I understand that's, you know, not always doable. It's certainly not always affordable for a lot of people. So I wouldn't say that's a kind of panacea. But I mean, getting involved, I think, is really important too. There's lots of citizen science projects out there. We can count butterflies and other things. You can kind of lobby politicians to get them to do more on this. You can obviously vote in appropriate ways on some of that kind of stuff. And all of that kind of fosters a better appreciation of love for insects, because I think that's key ingredient in all of this, is that we need to care about them before we save them.
And in that lovely sort of nature is healing way, the pandemic accidentally caused a few things to happen which inadvertently helped insects.
Yeah, that's right. We just kind of eased off a little bit, didn't we? We became a little less fussy. So we started cutting the grass next to motorways a little less, and we let things go a bit in cities so that plants could kind of rebound, and we started seeing wildflowers everywhere again. And that kind of brought back the insects, which then brought back other animals. We started seeing the kind of benefits of nature being allowed to kind of flourish and do its own thing. That's the kind of the encouraging thing about, I think, the insect crisis, is that we need to do a lot of things, but a lot of it is just about being a bit lazier in many respects, about doing less. Some things we just need to do less of. We need to be less fussy, have less kind of manicured lawn and that kind of thing. We just need to ease off. And once we ease off a bit, we can give them a chance.
So I've been talking to Oliver Millman. We've been talking about his book, The Insect Crisis, which is out now in paperback from Atlantic. Oliver, thank you so much for taking the time to tell me about it.
Thank you so much.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced, presented, and edited by me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is hosted by Acast and published by 89UP. The show is broadcast on Mondays and Saturdays on Resonance 104.4 FM. Thanks for listening.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.